begin with these words from the poet Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. There is a line there. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Hang on to that. We will circle back to it as we dig into the book of Job this morning. Before we get into the content of the book of Job, we should define what type of book it is, what type of literature we're dealing with here. The book of Job is not Torah or law. It does not claim to be history. It is not prophecy or wisdom literature. It is not a gospel. It is not a pastoral letter written to a community in need. It has poetry like the Psalms, but it also has narrative prose. It is a story, and is best categorized as a fable or a folk tale. It is more Hansel and Gretel than Isaiah or Corinthians. It is an early Jewish folk tale that does what all folk tales do. They tell a story about, in order to explore a moral question, and the moral question that the book of Job explores is a big one, perhaps the big one. Why does God permit bad things to happen? The book of Job asks, why is there suffering in the world? Why is there pain? Why is there evil? Why is there despair? And where is God in all of this? The narrative premise on which these questions are explored goes like this. Job is a wealthy and God-fearing man with a comfortable life and a large family. One day, far above it all, in the heavenly throne room, Satan, or the accuser, goes to God and says, if all this were taken away from Job, he would turn his back on you, God. And then after a back and forth, God tells Satan that, okay, Job is now in the accuser's power, and they will see what happens. It is essentially a social experiment, one where God gets to observe from a comfortable distance, but for Job, the implications are immediate and all-encompassing and tragic. He loses his wealth, and he becomes impoverished and is forced to beg in the streets. His children die, and his wife berates him. His body is afflicted with leprosy and boils. He spends his days in sackcloth, sitting in a pile of ashes, scraping his weeping flesh with broken pottery. Job looks at what his life has become, and all he sees are sharp edges that cut the body and the soul. Sitting in his ash heap, the world has become a place of hopelessness and ugliness and suffering and despair. So that's the setup of this tale. The next 29 chapters of the book, literally thousands of words, are chatter amongst Job and his friends about what to do about this new lot in life. They propose a myriad of theologies about why this has happened and envision dozens of strategies on how to approach God and demand answers. And then finally, Job has had enough. He cracks and he wails up to the heavens, up to God in the far removed throne room. Today, Job cries out, is my bitter complaint. His hand is heavy despite my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might go even to his dwelling place. I would lay my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn what he would answer me and understand what he would say to me. Job pours his guts out, shaking his fist towards the heavens, defending his integrity, demanding an audience with God, demanding answers from God. He wants to put God on trial. He indicts God for crimes against humanity, his humanity, through divine indifference. He rails and he rages against God from the very depths of his being. He rails and rages from the very depths of his suffering, his pain. Where are you? He cries out to the Lord. Where were you when my children died? Where were you when I lost everything? Where were you when my skin turned to fire and lost all dignity and self-respect? Where were you? As a book of folklore, the book of Job is asking the big moral question, why does God permit bad things to happen? And so, Job's questions are meant not to be unique to him. They are humanity's questions. They are our questions. Job's questions are our questions because his pain is our pain. His suffering is our suffering. His despair is our despair. Job, sitting in his ash heap, is a surrogate, an archetype for any of us who have looked up to the heavens and cried out, why? Why, God? Why did I have to get that diagnosis? Why is my child crippled by anxiety? Why did the factory have to close? Why did my lover leave me? Why did my parent have to die alone? Why did that fire have to happen, or that flood, or that famine, or that war? Why is everyone so angry all the time? Why has life lost its color? Why is the only thing that takes the pain away this needle in my arm? Why can't anyone see what I'm going through? Why do I feel so alone? And maybe, like Job, we also ask, where is God in all of this? Why? Why do you allow me to suffer? Why have you forsaken me? Now, a remarkable element of Job's story is that in all this why God and where God questioning, Job does not shift to if God. The anger that Job shows is a deep, primal form of faith. Despite everything he has gone through, everything he has lost, he has not stopped believing in God. Imagine the kind of faith it takes to trust God enough to condemn God. This is far removed from a pious, polished, and plastic faith that is way too often held up as the ideal. This is a raw faith. This is an ugly faith where everything is on display for God, even suffering, even despair. Where are you? Job rails and rages from the very depths of his being. And then, as we hear in the passage that Amanda read for us, God responds. The distance between the heavenly throne room and the earthly ash pit evaporates, and God appears to Job out of a whirlwind, out of a storm. Now, in a strictly literal sense, Job does not get the answers to his questions. In fact, God turns the tables on Job and asks him questions. Lots of questions, 60 questions, in fact. God addresses Job and says, I will question you, and you shall declare to me, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you when I flung the stars into the sky? Where were you when I set the limits of the sea? Where were you when I created the behemoth and the leviathan? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds and clap your hands and make the thunder roll? Did you orchestrate the rising of the trees and the greening of the leaves? Was it you, Job, that put wisdom in the inward parts of all beings? Was it you who gave understanding to the mind? What we get in the latter chapters of the book of Job is a third creation story, the first two being in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. What we see here, though, is an oration of the overpowering and bewildering everywhereness of God, the everywhereness of God. This is a God who knows intimately all the corners of the earth, every grain of sand, every drop of water, every creature's constituent parts, its yearnings and patterns of being. And despite what Job might think, this is a God that deeply cares for what God has created. This is a mothering God who has birthed her children into the chaos of the cosmos. God does not respond directly to Job's questions, but neither does God discount Job's suffering. God uses the story of creation to tell Job that God sees his suffering in the context of everything. God sees everything. God is everywhere from the beginning of time to the end of time. God is there. This may not be particularly satisfying for Job or for us. Job has still lost everything. We still experience suffering. And when we are suffering, it is all we can focus on. It can warp our worldview. It can cause us to react in hurtful ways. It can make us question or lose our faith in a God that feels absent. And this is the big risk that God takes. The big risk. God risks the relationship with Job and with us by acknowledging that sometimes there are no answers. Sometimes there are no answers to suffering and pain and even evil, even for God. Because God's will for creation is dependent upon the free response of creatures to act by the wisdom that God has placed in our inward parts. It is a big risk to put that kind of trust in us. The trust to allow us to fail and to fall and to suffer even through no fault of our own. This trust opens God up to grief. When bad things happen in this beloved world, the mothering God grieves for her children. As the poet says, "Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine." This sharing of despair, the sharing of the hardest, the ugliest, the most raw parts of ourselves is how deep and faithful relationships are formed with each other and with God. But in the address to Job, God is clear that suffering and grief is not the whole story to our lives. There is also beauty and grace and hope in the world, and this is what God points to. "I was there when the morning stars sang together and the heavenly beings shouted for joy. I was there when the seven star sisters found each other. I was there when Orion got his belt." By pulling back the lens to the scale of the cosmos, God provides a renewed and enlarged vision of what it means to be human. Humanity has a place in this world, a special place in this world. But humans are still creatures. Creatures along with the Leviathan and the behemoth, the fungi and the fir trees, the starling and the salmon and all the rest of the creatures who share in this world in which God delights. God is not dismissing Job, but is reorienting him within a larger awareness of God's good creation, of which we are a part, not the whole. When you look at the book of Job, this odd Jewish folktale written thousands of years ago, it is making two essential points. It is not all about us, and not everything depends on us. This story assures us that God is God and we are not. We are human beings who struggle with things we cannot understand. Nevertheless, our hope is tied to the firm conviction that this same God will take care of that which we do not understand, as we see in the created world around us. "Tell me about despair, "Yours, and I will tell you mine," writes Mary Oliver. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue sky, are heading home again. There are times when God feels distant or even absent from our lives, but as the poet goes on to write, "Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination. God's world, the world that God created and is still creating, continually offers yourself to its imagination, to your imagination. Images of wonder and feelings of awe have the gift of lifting us out of our personal circumstances to that which is true and beautiful and just." Have you ever looked up into the night sky and really considered what you were bearing witness to? Billions of galaxies, trillions of stars, uncountable planets, black holes, mysteries beyond our comprehension, the unfathomable vastness of the cosmos. Have you ever asked, what are we in all of this? So small, seemingly so insignificant. Who are we may wonder with the psalmist, that God would take notice of us? And yet, the gift that the book of Job offers is that in all of this vastness, the God of all creation chooses to erase the difference in space between heaven and earth and chooses to address one of us, one of us. God speaks about creation, but he speaks to Job, to us. God speaks to humanity in Torah and through the prophets and in Jesus, and sometimes in direct revelation into our places of awe and wonder and suffering and despair. God hears our cries of, "Where are you?" And through creation itself, God whispers back, "I am here. I am here. I am here. I am always here. In every place, from the beginning of time to the end of time, I am here. Take comfort, my child. I am here." Amen.